23. We're not adopting the amendment. We're just doing it as a do-pass.
Okay, everyone, I'm going to call today's meeting of the House Subcommittee on Higher Education to order. Today's Tuesday, March 15th. And we are going to start off today's meeting with a work session on House Bill 3123. And so I'm going to open this work session on House Bill 3123. And Anna, why don't you just remind us of what this bill is and if there are any amendments and what the disposition of the amendments are, et cetera.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3123 changes the name of the Tuition Protection Fund to the Tuition Protection Trust Fund. House Bill 21, or excuse me, 3123 clarifies the position of the state of Oregon to have no proprietary interest in the fund and disclaims the right to claim contributions made to the trust from sources outside the general fund. Monies in the trust are designated to protect students in the event that career schools cease to provide educational services and for administration and maintenance of the trust. It grants the superintendent of public instruction authority to maintain and administer the trust and requires the State Board of Education to adopt procedures governing the administration and maintenance of the trust, declares an emergency effective on passage. This bill also has a dash one amendment that expands the monies in the fund to include dollars deposited before or on or after the effective date, and I believe that the dash one amendment upon further review is no longer needed.
Okay. And we have the chief sponsor of the bill in the room, Representative Huffman. No need to proceed with the dash one amendments on your end, right? Great. Okay, Val, I would entertain a motion on this.
Chair Dumbo, I move House Bill 3123 to the House Committee on Education with a do-pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Hoyle moves House Bill 3123 to the House Committee on Education with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion. We had a good hearing of this on this last week or the week before. Erica, why don't you call the roll?
Representative Huffman?
Excused.
Representative Hoyle?
Aye.
Representative Woolsey?
Aye.
Representative Springer?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Excused.
And Representative Dumbo?
Aye. House Bill 3123, having received the necessary votes, is sent to the House Committee on Education, where if there's no objection, I will recommend that Representative Huffman carry it to the floor. Thank you. Okay. Okay, I'll close the work session on House Bill 3123, and I'll open a work session on House Bill 2221. Anna, remind us about this one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2221 authorizes the Oregon Student Assistance Commission to award Oregon Roadmap to Language Excellence Scholarships to qualified students. Initial scholarship of $2,000 to be awarded by OSAC to qualified students. Students are eligible to receive a maximum of $8,000 over 4 years, 4 academic years, by demonstrating measurable gain in language proficiency. Grants reduce scholarships at $500, less than amount received in previous academic years for students not demonstrating measurable gain, and prohibits awarding reduced scholarships in consecutive academic years. Requires OSAC to adopt rules governing scholarship administration, language standards, and assessment methods. Establishes the Oregon Road to Language Excellence Fund and appropriates monies in fund to OSAC for scholarship awards. House Bill 2221 also has an amendment, and I believe that Andrew from Representative Buckley's office is here to speak to that.
Okay, Andrew, would you come up and expose yourself to our questions? Thank you.
Chair Dumbo, members of the committee, my name is Andrew Ainsworth, and I'm here on behalf of Representative Buckley. So the dash one amendments to House Bill 2221 make 4 relatively minor changes to the bill. The first change would be removing the requirement that a student attend college or university immediately following their graduation from high school in order to be eligible for the scholarship. That change was made at Chair Dembro's request. We don't want to discourage students who may take a year off between their studies from trying to achieve the necessary requirements to get the scholarship. The second change does clarify that the scholarship must be used at a higher education institution in the state of Oregon. This was the original intent of the bill way back in 2008, before it was even introduced as a bill in 2009, and in the drafting process looked like that got left out. When it does come, hopefully in the future, the state will be able to allocate funds for the scholarship, and at that time, we wouldn't want to see those funds leave our state. And then the third change was suggested by OSAC, and that allows OSAC the flexibility to award a waiver to the requirement that a scholarship be awarded in consecutive years for a student who is on a approved leave of absence, such as military service, for example, or a family emergency illness, that sort of thing. And finally, there is some modification included in the amendment to the scholarship fund, or the language that sets up the scholarship fund, and that was done at the request of OSAC just to make this less of an administrative hassle for them and to allow them to distribute any private funds they may receive for the scholarship.
Okay, thank you, Andrew. Committee, yes, Representative Lindsay.
Could I just wanted a little bit further clarification on the last requirement. You said that they didn't want to have some administrative hassle. Can you just explain that a little bit further for me, please?
The original bill would have set up a separate fund for the scholarship, and it appears as though that is rarely done, and so we're just putting this more in line with the other scholarships that OSAC administers and distributes funds for, and makes it simpler for them to track. And so it would add it, it would
one
add
bucket.
The funds for this to ORS 348-570, paragraph 1, so the student assistant fund in there.
Okay.
Yeah.
And just to clarify, Andrew, OSAC can receive funds from all sorts of sources for this scholarship to go into that bucket.
Indeed. Yeah, right. Both private and public funds can go into that fund for distribution.
Right. Representative Lindsay?
And then maybe this is a question for you on your amendment, and that was, I get the point of not having them have to use it right after high school, so if they want to take a bonus year or something like that. Is there anything that... I guess my concern is that wide open, or is there some sort of 5 years or something like that? Or
yeah, I know I'm happy to answer that. My intent was that it would be open, because you have people who are coming back to school, making career changes. They've been in the military. There are just a variety of reasons that somebody's going to come back and, would be a good candidate for this scholarship, would have an interest in pursuing foreign language. So to have it, to just be thinking in terms of the student who's on a kind of straight track from high school to college or university right away, I think that would be limiting and unnecessarily limiting.
And just a follow-up question. So let's say they would get maybe awarded the scholarship in high school for showing that improvement, and they get the scholarship, but they can use it sometime later. They don't have to re-up or re-qualify. Or do I have that backwards?
I'm not sure that's necessary. Is it, Andrew?
Chair Dembro, Representative Lindsay, there does not appear to be any language specifying when you would apply for and qualify for the scholarship. I believe it would be the year before you intend to go to university or college in the state. So you wouldn't necessarily be applying for it your senior year if you weren't planning on going to college next year. You may wait a few years to apply for the scholarship. And at that time, you'd have to demonstrate proficiency in language for the initial scholarship, and then subsequent years, a gain in that proficiency in order to keep the scholarship.
Okay.
Further discussion? Okay, Representative Boyle, we're probably ready for a motion then.
Okay, Chair Dembro, I move the Dash 1 amendment.
Yes, thanks.
Okay, Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments. Dated 3/7/11.
Yes. Representative Hoyle moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated March 7th, 2011. Any further discussion on the amendment? Okay, seeing none. Without anyone have any objections to this amendment? Okay, then the Dash 1 amendments are approved. Now we go to the main motion. Vice Chair Boyle, I would entertain a motion.
Chair Dembrough, I move to pass House Bill 2221 to the House Committee on Education with due pass recommendation.
As amended.
As amended.
Yeah. Representative Hoyle moves House Bill 2221 as amended to the House Committee on Education with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion on the main motion? Yes, Representative Lindsay.
Yeah, so I think this is a great bill. I just want to make a couple statements, and that is I wish that we could implement this younger, when kids are 5, 6, 7, 8 years old. Having lived in Spain for a couple of years and learning Spanish while I was there, language comes a lot more easily when you're younger. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is that you have to be completely immersed in it to really grasp it. But I think this is good. I'd like to see us. I've been to Europe several times, and one of the best experiences I had was on a train in Amsterdam, and they had a little ticket guy come through. And he was talking to one person in German and one person, and he just came up to me and just started speaking in English. I said, well, I'm going to respond in Spanish, just to blow his mind. And I responded in Spanish, and it shocked him a little bit. And I said, how did you know I spoke English? And he says, well, you just look American. But I do think that languages bring understanding and dialogue to communication across borders, and that's what we need nowadays, and anything that we can do to assist there I think is good. So I'll be voting yes on this, and hopefully there'll be funds available. I know it's conditioned on whether funds are available, and hopefully parents will take the initiative when children are younger to immerse them in language as well.
Yeah, thank you for those comments, Rip Lindsay. And I should tell you, a couple of years ago when this a form of this bill was introduced 2 years ago, there was a conversation around the fact that knowing that this scholarship was out there might encourage families and children to pursue language, you know, knowing that language itself could pay off, you know, knowing foreign languages. And so, you know, it may be that having this out there is actually going to incentivize the kind of behavior you're talking about. We need it. Yes, Representative.
Actually, no, I'll catch up with you later.
Okay, great. Any further discussion? Okay, seeing none, Erica, you want to call the roll?
Parker?
He's excused.
Representative Hoyle?
Aye.
Representative Lindsay?
Aye.
Representative
Spader?
Aye.
Representative
Johnson? Aye. House Bill 2221 is moved to the House Committee on Education with a due pass recommendation.
As amended.
Mr. Chair. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Can I just close this?
I'm sorry.
No. I'm going to close this work session on House Bill 2221 and.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I would make a motion to suspend the rules in order for Representative Johnson and now Representative Parker to vote on House Bill 3123.
Good, I'm not alone.
Rep. Springer has moved to suspend the rules for the purpose of the two good representatives giving them the ability to vote on these bills. So, and just... Rep. Lindsay, just to remind you, the first bill was House Bill 3123, the one having to do with the Tuition Protection Trust Fund. Do you have any questions about it?
I do not.
Okay. And Rep. Parker?
I'm
just getting brought up to speed on the amendments and the status. No, I'm fine.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, Erica, you want to ask them?
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
And Harper?
Aye.
Okay, and then House Bill 2221. This is the bill about the foreign language scholarships. Rep. Parker, are you prepared to vote?
Do we need to, Mr. Chair, do we need to suspend the rules for that one? Because I specifically, and I didn't mean to exclude you on that. I'm sorry.
All right. So...
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion, if I may.
You certainly may.
That we make motion to suspend the rules for the purposes of allowing Representative Parker to vote on House Bill 2221.
Okay. Any objections? Okay, seeing none, we are suspending the rules. And Rep. Parker?
Just waiting for you to ask me.
This is your opportunity to cast your vote on House Bill 2221.
I'm prepared, sir.
Please do.
Aye.
Okay, Rep. Parker has voted aye. I will now bang the gavel. Okay, I am now going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3240. Anna, what is this bill about?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3240 permits the Board of Education of Community College Districts to establish police departments and commission police officers. This bill expands the definition of peace officer to include police officers commissioned by a community college district and grants commissioned police officers all the power and authority conferred to peace officers or other police officers of the state. This bill declares an emergency effective on passage. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. Actually, maybe we'll bring these two. Okay, I am going to call up Rob Wagner and Walden Perkins at the same time. And is Bob Baldwin on there? Bob, were you going to speak? Okay, I'll bring all three of you up. Welcome, gentlemen. It's a pleasure to have you here.
So, Chairs Dembrough and Johnson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rob Wagner, representing the American Federation of Teachers Oregon. We have members from pre-K through post-secondary, including five community colleges in Oregon. And with me today are two of our members from Lane Community College. They are truly the experts on the bill, and they're going to share some stories, their experiences at a campus level, around a little bit of background on this bill and why we're seeking it. But to clarify the intention, I want to state this, that the bill simply allows the conversation around campus public safety and the appropriate training needed in order to secure campus to happen at the local level. I just wanted to stress that. So it doesn't mandate that this happen. It just allows community college boards to consider, with all the other training standards that need to happen through DPSST, Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and all the other statutes that apply for peace officers. So that's with that, I'll turn it over to Bob to talk a little bit more about the bill itself.
Thank you, Chair Dembrough, Chair Johnson, members of the committee. The problem at Lane is fairly straightforward. We have potentially 30,000 students and another 2,000 staff members on campus at any given time. The primary campus of Lane Community College is in rural, unincorporated Lane County. It is not in Eugene or Springfield. We have no law enforcement agreements with Eugene or Springfield. We are at best 20 to 45 minutes away for response time for a Lane County deputy. We know that because 20 to 45 minutes is what we get when it's an officer in distress call from our own public safety officers. If it's something on the order of a car theft or some other theft type issue, it's file a report. That's the state of law enforcement for Lane Community College. We know that at any given time, we have known gang members, we have known drug dealers, and we have known career thieves hanging out on campus precisely because we are a target-rich environment. We know this. We have a backlog of unsolved thefts from vehicles, thefts from backpacks, thefts of backpacks, theft from staff areas, desks, briefcases, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We have drug deals routinely being conducted on campus during the evening hours. The challenge we have is that when we go to the administration and seek greater enforcement of the public safety standards on campus, we are told that can't happen. That can't happen because the legislature has not given public safety officers the authority to do so. Example, when public safety officer pulled over an individual for running a stop sign on campus and the window was rolled down, he smelled the very obvious smoke coming out of the car of marijuana. He pulled the individual out, had the individual step out of the vehicle, searched the vehicle, found marijuana, detained the individual. The theory was the individual represented a risk on the highway if he had left campus. The officer was reprimanded for an inappropriate search. The college standards, according to the chief finance officer, Greg Morgan, who currently oversees public safety, is that we simply shoo them away onto somebody else's jurisdiction. Let them drive out onto the highway, then call Lane County or City of Eugene or City of Springfield and let them deal with it. We've gone to the human resources director and the college attorney. We're told by them that the problem is that if individuals on our campus have a negative experience with public safety, they'll have a bad impression of the college and it'll look bad for us in the community. That's according to HR Director Dennis Carr and the college attorney, Meg Karen. That's the official policy of the college. Their objection to this bill when we brought the concept forward was not because they were supporting the safety of the students or the safety of the community. It's because acknowledging that we have a crime problem on campus and taking steps to solve it creates a public image problem for them. It's essentially the same argument that auto manufacturers used originally against mandatory seat belts in automobiles. It creates the impression of a safety problem. We do have a safety problem. Our public safety officers take weapons off of individuals on a regular basis, knives and guns. I've had an officer that I represented who was disciplined for exactly that, found marijuana and a loaded 45, was reprimanded for relieving the individual of both drugs and weapon. There's something skewed in the process at this point, and the defense the administration always has is we, as public, the public safety office on our campus, do not have probable cause search, and they do not have authority to detain. They can only observe and report. So no matter how great the offense, they just call the sheriff's department and hope something happens. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
My name is Walton Perkins, and I'm a public safety officer, a senior public safety officer at Lane Community College. I've been employed there for 12 years. As a private security officer licensed by the state of Oregon, you are familiar with the folks who rattle doors and observe while your car is being broken into and take notes and act as a professional witness. My personal belief is that what my employer desires of us rather than create any kind of an image problem. Lane Community College sits right on I-5 and 30th Avenue, a major thoroughfare through Lane County. I work primarily the swing shift. That's from 3 in the afternoon until 11 o'clock at night. I have 21 years in law enforcement, public safety. When I see a vehicle, two vehicles, as we say, doored up, talking, and they see a patrol vehicle arriving, and they both take off rather quickly off campus, it tells me they weren't exchanging some sort of Final Four tabulation. They're up to something. Every day we interact with people from outside the campus. Our students aren't the problems. We do have problem students. I'm not going to deny that. But the majority of the problems come out of people off campus. We have an LTD transfer station on our site. We know for a fact that one burglar would hit at a particular time and had his thefts timed down to the fact that he could get from where he had stolen the items to the bus, on the bus, and off property before we even had a chance to get the call that the theft had occurred. Those are the things that happen. Physical security, crime prevention, whatever you want to call it, very important in the college environment. When a student goes out and they sign off on a student loan, and they buy a $1,500 laptop computer for use, and through their own neglect or because somebody busted into the locker and they got that computer, that student's out $1,500 that they still have to pay for. We need to take a proactive measures to make sure that we can catch these individuals, we can cite these individuals in, we can do the investigation, and get them into a court system to where they're held accountable for their actions. In the last 4 years, 5 years, we've had 14 stalking incidents. And that's not just students, that's staff members. One person was so violent and so persistent that he brought a Marine Corps fighting knife to give to a female instructor who has made her lifestyle as a peace advocate very well known. But he wanted to give it to her as a gift. His words, a gift. Now, we didn't even get the chance to arrest him that day. All we could do was identify him and turn him loose because the Sheriff's Department did not have anybody available to come and pick him up. So we turned him loose, and then they eventually picked him up, not in Lane County, but where he was hiding out in Oak Ridge with his parents. And they finally got him there. We had another one who did 6 months in the Oregon Hospital Mental Health Institution because he did not believe that this instructor did not want anything to do with him. He was a student. She was a staff member. These are actual stories. These are people that I deal with on a daily basis. We're not asking for any kind of special authority. All we're asking for is the same authority that the officers of the Oregon University system have, the right to stop and frisk somebody, and the probable cause arrest authority. If any one of us in this room was on my campus and you were assaulted and left unconscious on the ground and I walked up and I saw somebody standing over the top of you holding a weapon that looked like they'd use it to hit you, all I could do was ask them to stand by. If you didn't want to, if the person didn't want to, they could leave. You're still injured on the ground, and that person's liable to get away with it because I don't have anything other than what physical description I can give him to the Lane County Sheriff's Department. And Bob wasn't off. One of our officers was almost ran down by a student who was then in the process of committing a burglary, or we suspect was almost ran down. It took 20 minutes for a Lane County Sheriff's deputy to arrive. They were coming from Florence, they were coming from Blue River, they were coming from anywhere they could. And they were trying to get there because, God love them, I really respect our Lane County Sheriff's Department. They do a lot more with a lot less than other people. At any given time, on any shift, maximum deputies for the entire Lane County is 5. That's it. And if we have a major problem out there on that campus, when we call, they know it's a problem, and they send everything they got because we don't call that often. We try to handle it in-house. So those guys, they earn every dollar you guys, or the state and the taxpayer gives them. I wouldn't want their job right now. I'll take any questions. I've talked enough.
Committee. Rep. Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a handful of questions, if that's all right.
Go ahead.
I'll go through you. First to you, I'm sorry, I forgot your name, gentlemen.
Oh, Rob Wagner.
Yeah. Sorry, Rob. Okay. You said that this does not mandate them to do this, but it allows them to consider it. But it does give them the authority to actually adopt it, correct?
Correct. Chair Dembrough, Representative Lindsay, that's right.
Okay. And follow up, Mr. Chair. Now the sheriffs can just deputize you over the phone or as they see fit, correct?
Anytime an officer can act as an agent of law enforcement, if and only if there is an active warrant, okay? We can act as an agent of law enforcement if we know that the individual has a warrant. We do have access to LEDs. I'm the LEDs representative for our department. We're recognized as a law enforcement agency by the FBI because of our college crime reporting statistics, which I've spoken on before. The thing of it is that they can't just arbitrarily deputize you. They can't just come up, call you up, and say, hey, you're now a deputy, go pick up so-and-so, or if I call them up and say, you want to sit there, would you come out and take charge of this guy? No, you're a deputy. I'm making you a deputy now. That doesn't work that way. All right, only the sheriff of a county can deputize people. And in this case, special deputy status is a possibility, but that's entirely up to the sheriff. And that's after we complete the necessary training through DPSST, Department of Public Safety Standards Training, or his recognized reserve academy. Did I answer your question, sir?
Yeah, it's probably another question, though, and that was, so if there's an active arrest warrant, you already inherently have the authority.
No, sir.
You do
we
not.
We have to call, confirm the warrant. Once we've confirmed a warrant and a sworn officer on the other end of the phone says, hold on to him, we're on our way to pick him up, we're acting as an agent of law enforcement to enforce that warrant.
Okay. And two other follow-ups. What additional training will there be for these people that want to be deputized? I'm assuming it's not the same as police or sheriffs.
It's the same. It would be the same level of training that the Oregon University System officers go through the academy at DPSST. Or, in our case, we would probably end up going through the Lane County Reserve Sheriff's deputies, which is the same training, the same level of training that every sworn officer in the state of Oregon has to go through. That program has been certified by, as I understand it, the Department of Public Safety and Standards and Training.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, say Lane County does this, then each of the, for example, you would have to then go through this additional training before you actually, and who would pay for that training?
That is out of my pay grade. Currently, the Oregon University System, I believe, pays for the people to go through the training at DPSST. All right. The training that's offered would be offered to us from the Reserve Academy. I believe, and I'm Bob would probably address that better, is that we could use that as our one class. We get by contract, we get one free, or we get our tuition free. And the college would pay for that, for whatever it costs. I believe it's like $700 for us to complete that course.
Okay, let me just jump in. And Administrator Teske has received some information from DPST.
Yeah.
For the record, Marilyn Lawrence, manager of the Standards and Certification Program at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, has submitted written testimony for the record. The department holds a neutral position on this bill, although they have concern for cost. But it is also my understanding that the department currently OUS schools reimburse the department for training.
Great. Okay. And then final question,
please. Sure.
And that was, you told the stories that I'm very well aware of, and I appreciate the efforts that you do on campuses. Similar stories could be told at malls. Would you think that the same thing should go for mall security officers?
No, sir. The difference is that they're in an environment where they have generally, they're in an environment where they have police departments. A lot of our community colleges. Community College of Central Oregon Community College. It's like two blocks from the Bend Police Station. Portland Community College, they've got Portland Police. Rogue Community College is inside the city once they got Grants Pass Police. When you're dealing with an outside agency, when an agency that's outside a city limits, you have to rely on that county sheriff and what assets he has. I can't speak to other colleges. Our college doesn't have that many assets. So when you're looking at a mall, you're looking at generally an organization that has immediate police response. I cite Valley River Mall in Eugene just a few months ago when they had the car shooting there. When the guy came in and started shooting the cars. Valley River Mall, they locked everything down in Eugene Police assumed that situation because Eugene Police was there within 3 to 5 minutes. There's a lot of difference between 3 to 5 minutes and 20 to 40 minutes when you're in a rural aspect of it. And you don't have many assets on the law enforcement side of the house. Even state police don't have that many assets anymore to respond to those. In a critical incident, when there's a shooting or anything like that, we'll get help from all over the place because those agencies have mutual aid agreements. So if the sheriff needs help getting bodies out to our college to respond to a critical shooting incident or something like that, agencies will supply bodies from all over to take care of that. You're not talking about you're talking about a mall comparison to a community college that has 30 buildings, 300 plus acres of land, and 30,000 people moving in and out continuously. There's a little difference between that college environment and that mall environment, which sits inside the city limits.
Thank you. Committee members, are there? Yes, Rep. Johnson.
Kind of a two-part question. Would these individuals who would be trained and official police officers, is it necessary that they be armed on campus, or is it simply enough that now they have greater authority because they are a police officer and not just simply a peace officer? Is their effectiveness because of what they pack, or is it simply the title that they possess?
It's the effectiveness of the law, the weight of the law behind them. All right.
Okay.
It's not necessarily. I know many universities, George Washington University, Washington D.C. They have a certified sworn police department. Their officers are unarmed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We don't deal with the level of crime, the family disputes, and those type of things that the average police department or the sheriff's department would respond to. Most of ours are thefts. So we don't have to be armed. We're not asking to be armed. Under the current administration, we wouldn't even begin to think about it.
Okay.
The point of it is that we have the ability with the stop and frisk to find those armed people, and we would have the probable cause authority to arrest those people based on a probable cause, not on a citizen's arrest, which puts the officer at risk for lawsuit later on. We have no immunity.
I have a comment.
So am I willing to take, even though I believe that individual committed that crime, I'm not willing to take the financial liability risk to go arrest that individual. I don't have any kind of immunity to protect me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Did you have another question, Jensen? Rep. Springer, you want to?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think basically I have a comment. I don't know if there's a question woven in here or not. And thank you all three of you very much for your testimony today. The one thing I heard that was just slightly concerning for me, and I would want to get some clarification for this, I was a police officer. I did go through the academy. I did all of those things. And if we're going to change this definition of peace officer, which is the bigger umbrella of deputy sheriff and trooper and police officers, there's not a difference between police officer and peace officer, unless a lot's changed in a few years. That said, the requirements then are the police academy. Again, if things have changed, then I'm wrong, and I'd want to get clarification. The academy, and then there's something called a field training manual, which is many, many hours that you go through with field training officer going through a gambit of experiences, and it's just that. It's field training, on-the-job training that has to be completed. And so I think that those are very real pieces. They're very good pieces, and they equip people to make appropriate and prudent decisions and respond appropriately. So that's not a good or a bad. It just is. So I just want to be very careful as we talk about this that we don't think we can go to a reserve academy and get the same level of training. I think what occurs there many times, and I've seen it in sheriff's departments I've worked in, they are deputized, if you will. They've gone through a reserve academy. It's definitely decreased hours by far, but good solid training. They go through that, and then wherever it is they're working on this end, it would be under the umbrella of the Lane County Sheriff's Department. So then you would have two government entities saying, whose fault is this? Which that's very problematic there. So I just, if we want to move forward, I think it would be very wise for us to get some clear counsel from Elsie and I still call it BPST, DPSST, on clarifying that issue for us.
May I make a sure. Comment to that? Yes, you're very correct. The thing that I understood, and it may, that the Oregon University system sends their officers to a special campus police or campus security officer training designed strictly for campus security and campus public safety in Monmouth, or now at the center in Salem here, okay, the training center. So I don't know if that's what happened. I haven't seen any training lately, maybe because of budget cutbacks they've curtailed that or whatever. But that is an option that's available to us. And that was specifically geared for those college officers that were going to be working not with full police powers. I want to please ask you to clarify that, not with full police powers. We're looking for stop and frisk and probable cause arrest authority. All right. We would only be on duty, well, a peace officer, those hours when we're actually working. Not 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It wouldn't authorize us to carry a gun. It wouldn't authorize us to make traffic stops out in town or anything else. I'd like to read something. Part of this is my job description. And it says that my duties are respond to calls for emergency assistance, resolve a variety of problems, including crimes against persons or property, hostile belligerent individuals, assess the potential for a perpetrator to be dangerous to self or others, conducts interviews and investigations concerning complaints, makes citizens' arrests, detain a suspect until appropriate law enforcement officials arrive, write clear, concise incident and crime reports, conduct traffic stops and issue citations, and provide assistance for emergencies such as medical, bomb threats, and fire. Those are the duties of a peace officer, not the private security officer, folks. Private security officers do not have the authority to go out and do a traffic stop and pull somebody over and write them a citation.
Mr. Perkins, what kind of training is required to do the work that you do?
Right now, all you have to do is be a licensed private security officer in the state of Oregon, and that consists of an 8-hour training day.
Okay. I ask that because I know at my college, at Portland Community College, many, if not all, of the officers are actually sent to the Monmouth Academy, or they were. So that's a choice that your college has made to not do that, right?
Right. And what I like to think is we do our own background checks on our people, and we do extensive background checks nationwide, NCIC, LEDs, the whole nine yards. Majority of our officers are former law enforcement. They're either retired or they've gotten out of business and decided to come back because it's less stressful at the college level. Okay, so the expertise is there. We have our own FTO program in-house that we train junior officers, and they're required to complete a packet before they're even allowed to work alone. So did I answer your question?
Yes, thank you. And Bob?
Thank you, Chair Deborah. I want to be clear with the committee that even under the best of circumstances, the bill passes, the administration at Lane Community College is fully supportive, and all reasonable efforts are made to implement this with all due haste. I would expect that it might be 3 to 5 years before we would see actual on-the-ground implementation. Nobody is under the illusion that if this bill were to pass, even with the administration's support, we would, in weeks or months, have this kind of authority bestowed upon officers. We're thinking of trying to build slowly over years. The challenge we have is right now we are in this perpetual deadlock where we push the agenda with the administration. The administration blames the legislature for not having even allowed the authority to be given, and therefore the debate is stalemates. So that's, we're trying to get past that one hurdle right now with a whole lot of hurdles left to go.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. And is one of the hurdles the financing, the budgetary? Have they raised that problem with you?
Chair Demery, yes, they have. And certainly that would be one of the reasons why I would think even with the best of intentions, 3 to 5 years in order to provide the funding, to secure the training, to build the cadre of officers, to implement the FTO program up to the standards that would be required. To do all those things would require substantial investment of both time and money.
Thank you very much. Are there any other questions? If not, I'm going to let you guys go. Stay close in case any questions arise that we'll need you for.
Thank you.
Thank you. And so speaking of the administration, I'm going to call up Karen Smith from the Oregon Community College Association.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Karen Smith. I'm the general counsel of the Oregon Community College Association, and we represent all 17 Oregon Community Colleges and their elected boards of education. I'm here today to clarify that OCCA and our college boards were not involved in the drafting of this legislation, and to clarify that we were not involved and did not know about it until the bill actually was drafted and dropped. While we have no position per se on this because we were not involved in drafting the bill, we do have concerns and believe that it is not necessary. We have also checked with all of our college boards, and there's not a single community college board of education that is interested in pursuing this authority and actually commissioning police officers. There are funding issues, training issues, all the things that you've just discussed, and our boards feel that this is not authority that they would like to have at this time. There are different needs on all of our different campuses, and our colleges have very close ties with local law enforcement, depending on what their needs are. They do have, right now in the statute in 241.300, they have the ability as a board to adopt regulations for the control of, for policing, control, and regulation of traffic on their campuses. And then, as has been mentioned, some have public safety officers who fill that role. Others work very closely with local law enforcement. And I wanted to give you an example of one of the colleges and how they've addressed the situation. At Clackamas Community College, since 1992, they've had a relationship with the Clackamas County Sheriff's Department, and where the sheriff actually has given authority to have sworn officers on Clackamas Community College campus. These are college employees. They are sworn through the Clackamas County Sheriff. They do, as sworn officers, have to go through the Reserve Academy training, and then they also have to undergo monthly training as well to maintain that status. And then they maintain current security officer status with the DPSST. There are currently 3 full-time sworn officers at Clackamas, 4 part-time sworn officers, and 1 part-time non-sworn officer on their campus. They do carry firearms. It's our only campus with sworn officers where they do carry firearms. They also carry an ID from the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office that states that they're limited duty officers. Their police authority only extends to their campus property, does not go beyond that. They are supervised by the director of their public safety department, who is also the chair of the Criminal Justice Department, and he's a former law enforcement officer who works not only very closely with the Clackamas County Sheriff, but all of the other local law enforcement agencies in their community college district. And I'm sorry that he was not able to be here today. He was hoping that he could provide some background, but he did send me this information as just one example of how one of our colleges reaches out and works with law enforcement to take care of the security and safety needs on our campuses. This is something we do take seriously and appreciate the opportunity to provide this testimony today.
Thank you, Karen. That's a very, very intriguing kind of model that they're using. So does the college assume all the costs of, you know, the training, the everything related to these employees?
Yes, Chair Dembro. The college does pay for their training, and they are considered college employees and entitled to all benefits that full-time and part-time employees are entitled to at the college.
So this is a model that's been out there since 1992, you said, but none of the other colleges has picked it up, as it were. Is that, do you think that's a function of relationship with their county law enforcement, or just because it sounds like a very intriguing model?
Yes, I think, Chair Dembro, that it did initially begin through a relationship with the county sheriff at the time in 1992, and all of his successor sheriffs have recognized the value of that relationship, and as has the college. And it is something that has developed over time on the campus as the discussion and debate over whether or not they wanted to have sworn officers who were carrying firearms on campus. That was a tumultuous time as they decided to go that direction, but over they said that they surveyed their college staff after 3 years of having sworn officers, and overwhelmingly the staff and students were supportive of having the officers and have felt that it works very well on their campus. But it is just one college that has adopted this model.
Thank you. Rep. Johnson?
Thank you. As you surveyed the colleges, I wondered, were they asked whether they were in favor of having armed officers on their campuses or just officers with the authority to actually frisk and so forth and so on, as we heard earlier? Do you know how that question was posed to them?
Chair Dembrough, Representative Johnson, yes, we asked if they had any interest in commissioning police officers. We did not talk about firearms at all, and the answer from our board members was no, we are not interested in that at this time.
Thank you.
Still, just to follow up, I think that's a fair question. You know, it may be that some people hearing that question might automatically assume that, you know, the question is, do we want armed officers? It's possible if the question were asked differently, the response might be a little different.
Chair Dembrough, this bill does give the authority to the board to commission police officers, and then subsequently throughout the legislation, it creates community colleges and treats them the same way as law enforcement agencies, including state police and other. So, you know, I think our board members in looking at this felt that this goes far beyond just providing public safety officers with stop and frisk and arrest authority. This actually creates a community college as a law enforcement agency and at the same level as state police and all other local police departments, and I'm not sure that they're ready for that conversation yet.
Right. So there may be some form of this that they might be supportive of. Is that, I mean, something that wasn't so ambitious, let's say.
Mr. Chair, we definitely have to take that back to them. Yeah. We didn't discuss that with them.
Great. Thank you. And more questions, Ms. Smith? Thank you, Karen. Great. So time for the sheriffs. No. Brian DeLashmit, Kevin Campbell, I'll call you both up.
Mr. Chair, you missed on both accounts.
Okay, the posse. I'm sorry.
Yeah, the posse.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. We've had a chance to look at this bill. We oppose the bill as it's drafted right now, and I'd like to explain why. It is interesting to note that there is a discussion on another bill in the Senate, Senate Bill 405, related to university police. Our association, in fact, three of our members, Chief Terry Holderness from the Ashland Police Department, Chief Ed Boyd from Albany PD, and the chief from Eugene have been actively involved interacting with this bill, 405, to discuss its merits and to try to work out a solution that works really well for both the university system and local police departments. I will say that the discussion today has brought up some of those very same issues that we care about. I'd like to mention just a few. You've already covered training. We believe as an association that if you're going to be a police officer, you need to be a police officer. And I'd like to give you an example of what happens when part of the tools related to policing are taken away. And the example, unfortunately, relates to a bill that was passed last session when OHSU was granted a police department. They're still getting up and running, but in their bill, they prohibited the use of firearms. The result of that has been troubling, in particular to the Portland Police Bureau, who has had to respond on a number of occasions up to OHSU to handle situations, use of force situations that got out of hand up there and created even a greater safety risk, not only for the police officers that were at OHSU who didn't have the full range of use of force options, but for the Portland Police Bureau coming in to respond. Why is that an issue up there? Well, OHSU is an emergency room. That emergency room often has individuals that come in. They could be someone in crisis. They could be are the result of a gang shooting, where they're actually taking people from an altercation to the emergency room, and the battle follows the trip to the hospital. So as our association, we've come together and we've basically said, you know, there is a place for security on campus, and there's a role for security, and there are limited tools and authority to go with that. We do believe, though, if there is a police department that's created, there's a couple parameters that we feel are very important. One is that the 16 weeks of basic training is fulfilled at the academy. We feel like that's very important. That training is essential so that a police officer has the full range of capabilities, along with their FTO or their follow-on training that occurs actually at the department afterwards. Second of all, that they have all the tools at their disposal. So if they are a police officer, indeed they are a full police officer. This does not require, of course, if Senate Bill 405 passes, for instance, a university to go this direction. There are other options for working with local departments or a full range of other options to make sure that security is taking place on campus. The third piece that's very important to our association is the management of a police department. Because currently any police agency in the state, the management of that police department, the supervisor is required also to have certain levels of certification within a certain time period. These are law enforcement managers, and we feel like it's very important when you're supervising a law enforcement department, because there are so many unique challenges related to policing, everything from the liability that occurs in the course of law enforcement's work to any number of problems that occur because of poor supervision or inadequate supervision. We believe that law enforcement supervision should be supervised by law enforcement trained and certified professionals, which is also done through the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. At this point, we are having conversations with the University of Oregon in particular, which I believe is the only university right now that is interested and able to fully fund a police department in the state. That's another issue that I think community colleges would recognize, that to actually fully equip a police department and to have a police department is very expensive. You're not just talking about the police officers themselves, but in any number of pieces in addition to that. That's not really our issue, but I know it's an issue for community colleges at this point. Our issue more is to make sure that the profession that's on campus would be fully equipped to be a police department as it's defined. I really appreciate the time to talk about this. This is the kind of issue that we would like to engage partners in a discussion about in advance. This bill was dropped. We had no idea about it. University of Oregon, on the other hand, has pursued us in conversation, and I think we are working through the details in order to figure something out that we feel like will work for law enforcement. It will be represent safety for students as well and workable for the university system. And so with that, co-chairs and members, I appreciate the time today. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin, for that. Brian?
For the record, Brian DeLashman. I represent the Oregon Council of Police Associations, which is local law enforcement, as well as the Oregon State Police Officers Association, the state troopers. We, too, oppose the bill, many of which you've heard from Kevin Campbell. It's not very often that the two of us get to sit at the table side by side and totally agree on point after point after point. There's usually some place where we deviate. But a couple of points that I wanted to touch upon. After setting through the budget process and Ways and Means, and DPSSC's budget in particular, it's becoming even more apparent that cuts in DPSSC's budget and OSP's budget and everybody else's budget is creating a problem with access to training at DPSSC itself. I became aware over the last several months that we're having a higher than usual number of retirements of both troopers and local law enforcement, partly related to discussions about PERS, but a variety of issues. And with the cuts at DPSST, I truly do not believe that there's going to be adequate resources there to not only train the existing officers for existing law enforcement, not alone an expansion. We believe that in order for this bill to go forward, or the university system, that these people need to be fully certified, as Kevin has indicated, the 16 weeks. They need to be fully certified as police officers, have all the powers, duty, and authority of police officers, not just to be listed as peace officers in the entire statute. Also, in reading through the bill, There are a number of places where peace officers are mentioned or the same status as peace officers, and they include a variety of things, but that's the ability to carry firearms off of campus as well as an individual. And so this bill does kind of go far afield. We understand fully, and I guess I commiserate with my union brothers that are proposing this bill, but I think this bill needs additional discussion. We would just as soon engage in that discussion during the interim, see if there can't be a solution that meets their needs, but without giving them full peace officer status and not, at the same time not going through full training. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Questions of either Brian or Kevin? Okay, thank you very much, and I really appreciate your offer to meet with the individuals and continue the conversations. Frankly, you know, what we heard from, certainly from Mr. Perkins is a sense of frustration in difficulty for him in doing his job under the current circumstances, and so, you know, whatever we can do to sort of improve this situation would really be very useful. Thank you. Okay, with that, I will close this public hearing on House Bill 3240. And Anna, what do we have ahead of us?
Thursday.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On Thursday, the 17th, we will have a public hearing on House Bill 2866. We're revisiting that bill, as well as House Bill 3521 and House Bill 3356.
Okay, great.
Like so
transfer and college completion on Thursday.
Are there? Those are work session?
I believe.
No. Those are public hearings.
All three.
No work sessions on Thursday.
Right.
Three hearings.
Okay, with that, I will close this hearing. Thank you all for your attention.
Okay.